Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We are here today for case number 172553, GLG Farms v. Brandt Agricultural, appeal from a decision of the District Court in the District of North Dakota. We had argument in this case once before, but there was quite a bit of disruption. Having re-listened to the argument itself, I can understand the concerns that were raised in the motion for rehearing. To be honest, we were not as affected by it as you all apparently were. Listening to it again, it sounds like it really was disruptive. We did not hear the full scope of that. We were able to hear you, but whether you all were able to really focus on what we were saying is a whole different question. So we decided collectively that we would grant the motion for rehearing and to give the appellant another opportunity to present his argument. And you want 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, you may begin.
Please, the court. My name is Chad Ziegler, counsel for appellant GLG Farms. I first want to thank you for inviting us back to argue the case on rehearing. The client thanks you, and the client's daughter thanks you too. She got a second trip to DC out of this to explore. I'd like to start off with just a premise that, with respect to the drive assemblies at issue and as claimed, it's important to keep in mind that these wheels are, in fact, driven. The hopper itself, according to the patent, identifies the problem that these augers are heavy and difficult to manipulate. Driven wheels, as we all know, require load. So it makes perfect sense that the claim would require that the driven wheels, so the assemblies, or the assemblies themselves, be mounted to the base wall. It's no different than a car where the wheel assembly is mounted to the chassis to take advantage of load. The question that's come up in briefing and in argument becomes then, are there any special constraints in the arrangement of the drive assembly components as far as how they can be spaced and arranged? With a car, the question would be, are the wheel assemblies constrained to the boundaries of the chassis? And we all know the answer to that is no. We don't see cars driving around with the wheels tucked under them. But instead, the wheels and axle extend beyond the chassis to take advantage of not only the load of the chassis, but to provide space for stability and to make larger tires, frankly.
Do the claims of the patent, do they contemplate using the drive assemblies in order to replace the existing wheels?
The question as far as replacing, that's a loaded question, Your Honor, respectfully, because replacing existing tires would presume that it's a...
How about if I use the word use instead of replace? Is that better?
Yes, and I would say that the question is, can the drive assemblies be in the place that a support tire might normally be? Absolutely, yes, they can. My problem with the premise is that it assumes that there are non-driven support tires there, which would then mean that this is a retrofit.
So it doesn't make sense to have all these multiple wheels, right, on at use. So it would seem that the patent does contemplate that if it's going to use the wheels, that it's going to replace any existing wheels that are already on there.
That's correct, and that's actually discussed in connection with Figure 2 of the patent. In regard to Figure 2, the patent states that there may be provided non-driven wheels on the end wall, or these may be omitted depending on the model. So, for example, in the model of Figure 2...
But whether they're omitted or not, their use is no longer necessary.
That's correct. And I'm emphasizing that point by pointing to Figure 2. Figure 2 shows one without any support wheels. And in that example, the drive assembly is right there in the middle to support the otherwise unsupported hopper. If you add two tires, or if a designer wanted to add two unsupported wheels to the mix, you would have, like a car, two driven wheels and two undriven wheels. And there's reasons to do that.
That's my question. What reason would there be to have undriven wheels?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What reason would there be to have undriven wheels?
Stability. And I can demonstrate that to you in connection with a figure in the Healy patent, which we've talked about a little bit. The Healy patent shows...
Do you have an appendix site?
I'm sorry. Appendix 105. If you conceptualize a hopper having a pair of, let's say, support tires, and you are going to add a pair of driven tires to them, what you would find is the driven tires would be spaced naturally away from the undriven tires to create a wheelbase, much like a car. So having four tires on a hopper, just like a car, provides a wheelbase. It provides support. And the point I'd like to make in connection with this, the additional point, is that whereas Figure 2, which we've talked about, shows, in that instance, a drive assembly smack dab in the middle of base walls, if you were to design a four-wheeled hopper, two wheels support, two wheels driven, the designer would naturally move those tires away from the support tires. Much like with a car, you would never have the undriven wheels adjacent to the driven ones. Picture going over a speed bump, for example. So the claims contemplate that these drive assemblies can be moved, adjusted. They contemplate that there can be support wheels. There may not be support wheels. But I would say, however, that the patent is silent about, but certainly wouldn't contemplate, is having four support wheels with the addition of a set of driven wheels.
So are you describing these Healy wheels as support wheels or driven wheels?
These are, in this example, driven, but you can envision that if it's not driven, somebody's pushing it. So essentially, this system, if it's just driven wheels, is something that's pushed. But these type of hoppers can have, you know, no wheels and be fixed to the swing tube. They can have two, as in this example, or they can have four in the other Healy example. I'm using this particular example to illustrate how that arrangement might look.
So Healy's listed as prior art in the patent, right? In your patent?
That's correct.
So obviously, at the time of the patent, you contemplated driven wheels on the end walls. I mean, you were aware of the existence of a patent with driven wheels on the end walls, right?
I mean, it's shown. The connection is interesting. If you look at Figure 8 in Appendix 105, the connection is actually on the base wall. The patent itself admittedly talks about the wheels being on the end wall, but there's nothing, there's no criticism of that particular setup. The criticism of...
It's on the end walls, it's between the end walls, that the wheels are between the end walls. I thought you said that they were on the end walls.
No, in Healy. We're looking at
We're talking about Healy. What I'm in addressing Judge O'Malley's question, yes, you know, the patent obviously recognized this configuration, but what it pointed out was not that the wheels being in this configuration are deficient or inferior. Instead, the focus of discussing Healy was to distinguish the invention as having two independent drives, which would eliminate the need for what you see in Figure 8, which is item 58 is an axle, 59 is a drive chain. That's the lone criticism of this configuration.
Is the drive chain.
Is the additional machinery that girds the hopper. As you can imagine, with these machines, the less moving parts on the outside of the hopper, the better. They're not protected. These axles can be bent or broken. And the point of having twin drive, you eliminate that.
All right. So, you know, as I'm sure you recall from the last time we were here, we were not persuaded that the district court was correct that the wheels had to be placed midway between the two end walls. Mm-hmm. And in fact, your friend on the other side pretty much conceded that they weren't pushing that point.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't answer the question of whether they should still be between the end walls.
Sure, and I'll address that. The first and foremost, the claims don't require that particular limitation. And if we're just looking at the claims, and I'll turn to the spec in a second, if you were to propose that that's some sort of a constraint, if you read the claims, that's an arbitrary one, and it's extraneous.
Well, if just looking at the claims, let me ask you what is the relationship between the third paragraph and the fifth and sixth paragraph. So in the third paragraph says a hopper connected to an outer end of said swing auger, the hopper having a pair of end walls and a base wall interconnecting the end walls,
mm-hmm.
and defining first and second side edges at right angles to the end walls. And then when you get to the two paragraphs about the drive assembly, you refer back to the first side edge and the second side edge. Isn't it at least arguable that by saying that you define the first and second side edge by having a base wall that interconnects the end walls?
When I read that, what comes to mind is the simple notion expressed in the specification that it's defining a trough. It's defining a, call it what you will, it's defining a bucket, it's defining a trough. Trough is the word that's used in the patent. A trough is going to have a base to it, it's going to have side walls, and the wall will then have an edge. For the patent, for the drive assemblies, the question is, are they arranged for mounting on the base wall portion of that structure?
Okay, so assuming the claims are at least unclear, or the claims don't contain a explicit limitation, what do we do with the language in the specification that repeatedly talks about the arrangement of the present invention?
The arrangement of the present invention in the particular context is, again, Figure 2.
Mm-hmm.
And what Figure 2 shows is a hopper with non-supporting wheels. And in that arrangement, you're going to put the driven wheels under center. Much like if you switch off to a motorcycle, the two wheels, now that it has two, not four, it's going to be under center. It's going to be centered underneath the load,
mm-hmm.
to support and drive. Whereas if we refer back to that Healy reference with the two non-driven wheels and you have two driven wheels, you're going to have a different arrangement. You're going to have a different arrangement. You are going to move from the center, where it was in Figure 2, elsewhere, away from the non-driven tires to create a wheelbase. And the patent claims specification allow you to do that. It's perfectly allowable. And again, with respect to
the question is, does it allow us to do it, or does it tell us that that's the way it's done? I mean, you do differentiate. You describe the prior art as having the rear wheels rotatably attached to the end walls, and then you say the arrangement of the present invention is shown in figures 2, 3, and 4. And as you concede, figures 2, 3, and 4 only discuss something where they are between the end walls.
Yes, but the proximity of the discussion doesn't mean that it's making a distinction in that regard. The distinction, again, with respect to Healy, has only to do with the connectivity of those elements in Healy to drive it by a single motor, with the mount being on the swing tube. So I would submit that though they are adjacent disclosures, they're not speaking to one another. Figure 2 speaks to an embodiment of the invention where you have non-driven tires. Once you have introduced the concept of putting a couple more on, it because it only has to be arranged for mounting on the base wall and not midway between, you can certainly say that it can be slid in one direction or another to account for what are common issues and constraints with anything driven by wheels. I like the car analogy. You have driven wheels and non-driven wheels, and they're not near one another, nor would you put them near one another.
But I guess, again, my problem is that you have what we generally treat as magic words, the present invention, even in the brief description of the drawings, you talk about figure 2 showing the addition of two drive assemblies of the present invention on the hopper. Mm-hmm. So you have that language, and yet, so the question is, to what extent do you believe there is any support in our case law to say that that language can be overcome by references to a preferred embodiment when there's no other embodiment even discussed, much less disclosed?
Two things. One is the preamble to all of that discussion on column 2 says that one embodiment invention will now be described in conjunction with the accompanying drawings, and then it recites some of the figures. So the preamble makes clear that it's an illustration. The fact that in describing figure 2, the disclosure also says, hey, you can have non-driven tires too, or not, that introduces a concept. And that concept is, how does that arrangement then fit in with that particular scheme? One of ordinary skill in the art would know that that's going to change the configuration in some way. In fact, will, because you're not going to want to have non-driven tires next to driven ones. You're going to want to space them apart. So that disclosure tells you that this is a non-limiting embodiment. The second is the claim itself. Claim 1 was filed with the application. So it issued as it was filed. It's part of the spec. It, by itself, admittedly, would never be read so narrowly as figure 2. So I think coupling that claim, the breadth of the claim, the spirit of the invention, and then also the preamble language, figure 2 is non-limiting. And it makes sense. Again, because in that example, you have a hopper that doesn't have support wheels in that instance. And in that instance, you're going to put them right underneath it to support and drive. Whereas if you have support wheels, they can share that burden.
Well, do you buck up against a written description problem if you say that we didn't disclose any other embodiment and yet our claims need to be broader than that?
If you look at figure 2 again, these connections are fairly simple. These things are bolted on. You can just slide it. I don't mean to put it glibly, but I don't think there is required to be extensive written description of something so simple. And a concept so simple and well-known when you're driving essentially a vehicle on four tires, two of which are driven, two of which are not, as an example.
So tell me where in the specification you can point me to anything where the spec doesn't contemplate the wheels between the end walls.
Where it doesn't? Mm-hmm. Well, figure two is the lone embodiment. Mm-hmm. It's depicted as being between them.
Correct.
Yes. There's not an express statement that says, oh, by the way, you can have some of the elements hang off the base wall or beyond it. But I don't think that's necessary. I mean, in the example of Healy, if you put these figure two assemblies on there and slid them down towards the intake away from the non-driven tires on the opposite end, you could very well have the motor hanging out there a little bit. You could have portions of the wheel hanging out there a little bit. There's nothing to constrain a designer or someone of ordinary skill in that area to not take advantage of that space.
Okay. All right, we're way over time. I gave you extra because of the circumstances, so you're about five over. I'll give you three back for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
With some flexibility on that as well. And we'll hear from the other side.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I'm Ann Schellen. I'm counsel for Brandt. Your Honor, I think you've hit on some of the very issues with this patent. This is a patent that was drafted very narrowly. It's got one embodiment. It has the magic language of the present invention is the one embodiment that's described in figures 2, 3, and 4. It's got very narrow claim language. It requires, as you noted, that there be end walls.
It doesn't really... I'm not so sure the claim language itself is that narrow. You know, isn't it clear that you have to hang your hat on a disclaimer?
Oh, I don't think so, Your Honor.
Okay, so tell me why that is.
So the claim limitation that really is at issue here is the claim limitation that each drive assembly is arranged for mounting on the base wall adjacent the side edge of the hopper. So on the base wall is explicitly in the claim limitation itself. It doesn't say that the drive assemblies have to be arranged on either side of the hopper.
On the base wall is a different debate, right? I mean, as to whether or not your product is mounted on the base wall, right?
Well, I think that is... fairly clear where our product is mounted. There is an end wall on each side that the base wall is between the two end walls. The side edges, which are formed by the walls of the base wall, are at 90 degrees to the end walls. So the only way they can be between the end walls is the only way they can each be at 90 degrees to the end wall is if they are in fact...
Right, I understand, but I thought we were talking about two different arguments here. One is that it has to be between the end walls, and then the other argument is even if it doesn't have to be between the end walls, it's still not on the base wall. And that one, to me, raises more of a potential issue of fact, the second argument.
That you would suggest, Your Honor, that what GLG would refer to as the bracket
mounting, yes, that's what they refer to.
Right. But we think that as the patent has described it, what mounted on means is where is the attachment point? Where is it connected? There's no question that the bolts that ultimately hold the Brandt drive assemblies are attached and go through the end wall.
So did the district court actually construe mounted on?
The district court construed the entire claim limitation And I think that's important as well, because it is an entire, you look at the entire phrase, which is that it's arranged for mounting on the base wall adjacent the first side edge of the hopper or adjacent the second side edge of the hopper. That arranged for mounting on the base wall adjacent the first side edge, when several lines up, as you yourself just noted earlier, says that the base wall interconnects the end wall, and I'm at line about 31.
Right, but if there is a way to be adjacent the sidewalls, even if you're outside the sidewalls, and still have your mounting connected to the base wall, wouldn't that be enough?
I'm not sure that I know what that looks like, Your Honor, but I think with regard to the Brandt product, it's clear that the bolts that hold it on are in the end wall and solely in the end wall. What GLG would like to call its bracket consists of something that it calls vertical one. You know, it doesn't want to call that whole piece at the end of each end of the hopper or end wall. But even if you say that what Brandt has done is attached to what GLG calls vertical one, that still doesn't meet the limitation literally of the claim. And then if you look to equivalence, GLG has several problems. Number one, the one you've identified, which is the magic language present invention, which specifically talks about that one configuration where you've got the drive assemblies mounted directly to the base wall, even if there is a bracket in between them. But that doesn't allow you to have an equivalent so broad that an attachment on the end wall, outside the end walls, not at all on the base wall, that would be considered an insubstantial difference.
So your view is that having an attachment on the sidewall, and I know you debate this, but if that attachment only works because you have it supported by a bracket to the base wall, that's not relevant?
I don't think it's relevant in this context, Your Honor, with these claims and this description. I think those supports recall the rest of the L-shaped bracket, if you will, is in each of the four corners of the hopper and has been there long before this patent application was filed. Those brackets are used to keep the whole thing square and to support it. They absolutely are. Said another way, Your Honor, if those brackets weren't there, if those L shapes weren't there, the drive assembly won't fall off. You know, the whole wagon may be wobbly, but the drive assembly won't fall off.
Is that a question of fact, though?
Oh, I don't think so, because I don't think they even get to doctrine of equivalence. Even if you assume that they're entitled to equivalence, they have a problem with the evidence that they put in. They have basically arguments, and if you look at their expert report, which is at appendix 20-22, and it starts on appendix 20-22. And you'll see in paragraph 30, which the majority of that is on page 20-22. Mm-hmm. This is talking about the bracket and Mr. Fall's supposition that all we have to do is kind of, I believe the phrase that Mr. Ziegler used last time was to nudge the bracket over a little bit. But if you look here, Mr. Fall gives no evidence that would tell you that the Brandt construction is insubstantially different from the literal construction of the claims. All he says, the last sentence there of paragraph 31, is that the differences between the reconfigured bracket and the accused bracket would be insubstantial in the context of the 131 patent. He's not doing a doctrine of equivalence analysis. He is comparing the Brandt actual product to his supposition, his hypothetical, And he hasn't shown, he hasn't walked through the claims, he hasn't given the particularized evidence that is necessary to show how the Brandt accused equivalent would meet the literal language of the claim term. Same thing is true for the function way result analysis that Mr. Fall did. Continuing on in his expert report, start at paragraph 33, which is on the appendix 2025. And he says, it's my opinion that the function of having two independent driver assemblies arranged for mounting on separate sides of the hopper wall is to locate the driver assemblies on the hopper in arrangement that efficiently swings the hopper. Importantly, that is not the claim limitation. That is the claim limitation that GLG would like very much today to have left the patent office with. But that isn't the claim limitation that it did, in fact, obtain from the patent office. It's not just that you have two independent drive assemblies arranged on either side of the hopper. It is, in fact, that you have two drive assemblies, each of which is arranged for mounting on the base wall adjacent the first side edge of the hopper. So even if there could have been a question of fact, Judge O'Malley, the facts weren't there. The last thing I'll point out is that Mr. Fall also references some testing that he did. And if you look there, it's at Appendix 2027 at about paragraph 37 of Mr. Fall's expert report. And there, he talks about testing. I'll let you get there.
Okay. Which paragraph?
Paragraph 37.
Okay.
He talks about testing the accused easy swing hopper mover. That's the Brandt product. The auger jogger, that is GLG's own product, which has the same configuration as the Brandt product in that the drive assemblies are mounted on the end walls. And a walking beam style mover. The walking beam style mover is an admitted prior art. It's described in the patent. That comparison, again, there's no comparison of a product that meets the literal configuration of the claim term against the accused equivalent. That's not the kind of testing. What he tests here is comparing the accused device to the prior art and concludes they're different. They may well be, or they may not be, but that's irrelevant as to doctrine of equivalence. So the facts that the GLG would like the court to believe it submitted aren't facts that the district court felt it could rely on because there wasn't an analysis. And in fact, the district court noted this problem with all the evidence that was submitted by GLG in its argument, or I'm sorry, in its opinion. I believe it's Appendix 10. But give me 1 second here. If I go to the court's opinion on granting summary judgment of non-infringement, if you look at Appendix 10, at the last two lines, said GLG did not include as a function the location of the drive assemblies beyond those arranged for mounting on separate sides of the base wall. What GLG is asking this court to do is to revamp the claims and to obtain for it broader claims than it attempted to get at the patent office, and that, as you yourself noted, are described and supported by the specification as it was submitted.
Well, you can see that because there really was no back and forth with respect to the specification, that we don't have any prosecution history that would impact this.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. I absolutely agree with that and understand that.
Well, what do you do with the fact, as your friend on the other side pointed out, that there is pretty specific language in here that talks about one embodiment of the invention will now be described, and that there is no actual criticism of the prior art that relates to the placement of the wheels vis-a-vis the end walls.
I understand all of that. I don't disagree. I think that, however, the flip side is that the patentee, continuing on through the application, did, notwithstanding the slightly broader description in the description of the drawings, when push came to shove and they really had to talk about how is the whole claim device, their invention, their present invention, arranged, they used the words, the arrangement of the present invention. So I think that that coupled with the very precise language that they submitted to the Patent Office, and which admittedly was their initial submission, if you will. They didn't go back and forth. They didn't try to broaden it out. I really think that what a person of ordinary skill in the art, reading this patent, reading these claims, would understand that what the inventor felt that he had invented was, in fact, drive assemblies mounted on the base wall, adjacent or on the side edge, depending on how you see the side edge, between the end walls, just as it was pictured.
Well, you're not necessarily agreeing with the district court's conclusion that adjacent necessarily means on, are you?
And that was the point. You and I discussed that, Your Honor, when we were here last. And you had made a reference a few moments ago to the fact that we conceded that it midway. And I think that was a different argument that had happened at the district court level. But you and I did absolutely talk about, does on have to be that very edge, you know, the point, if you will, the apex of the sidewall? I don't think so. And I think
that would read Figure 3 out of the patent.
Right. And we believe that Figure 3 is covered by the claims of the patent. And I think it's in part answered by a point that you made earlier where you were talking about reading, again, the words of the claim, and I'm up at line about 32, column 4, where you've got the base wall interconnecting the end walls and defining first and second side edges at right angles to the end walls. I don't know that language is as narrow as the picture in that. The picture has a line that goes to a point on the drawing, but I think you could read those side edges as being those side walls, those base walls, in which case I think that it does need to be on. If you feel that side edge is just the point on the very edges, then adjacent is perhaps, as the patentee chose, is the proper word. But in either case, it doesn't change the district court's, the propriety of the district court's final judgment, which was that there is no infringement literally, and there is no infringement under the doctrine of equivalence. And I think you can support that two ways, either because of the narrow language in the claims, and in the specification, GLG isn't entitled to equivalence so broad as to cover something mounted on the end walls, or because, in fact, they didn't support, as they are required to as the patentee, their equivalence argument with particular facts and linking argument. For that reason, we think that the district court's decision should be, our judgment should be affirmed.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, first, unless the claim could somehow be written to limit it to some sort of universal retrofit aftermarket attachment to an existing hopper with wheels, there's nothing in the claim that would constrain the assembly or restrain it to within any kind of boundary. The only question is it mounted to the base wall and how? And we put in proof that I think creates an issue of fact that bracket is extraneous to the end wall and the base wall. It's something new. And if you look at the patent itself, nowhere in the figures and the drawings do you see such a bracket as described. So there is a question of fact as to whether that bracket is a mounting to the base wall, much like, back to the chassis, whether suspension arms connecting the wheel assembly to the chassis is a mounting. It's still the wheel assembly is still mounted to the chassis despite there being the interposition of a suspension arm. Here, we should be entitled to prove the same. Now, I'd also like to point out that Brandt had an earlier prototype. And in that prototype, which is shown at APPX 2018, they indeed did try to bolt the assemblies just outside the intake.
Just a second, let me get
this. Sure.
Okay. Got it? Okay. Okay.
But then later had to move it to the spot that we're discussing now, that bracket that we should be entitled to prove is amounting to the base wall, which leads me to doctrine of equivalence. The reason that Brandt arranged the tire in the way it did is very similar to the reason that a wheel assembly in a car is moved away from the chassis. You could put a bigger tire on it, put a more aggressive tire, and have it sitting underneath the structure. But on the issue of doctrine of equivalence, that the fact that you can put on an aggressive tire is irrelevant to whether it also accomplishes the functional way result of the patented claim. So we put in evidence to show that in testing, not just particularized testimony, but in testing, this device did exactly what the invention sets out to do. What we did in the testing is compare it to what's called a walking beam, which Ann mentioned earlier, and that's the prior art device that's referred to in the patent as the Mayrath hydraulic mover. So it was perfectly sound for us to take the prior art and compare how Brandt's performed to demonstrate that whereas with the walking beam mover, which had a mover mounted on the swing tube, if you ran into rough terrain, the swing tube at times would the hopper would sometimes lift the swing tube off the ground and it would spin out. We demonstrated that, and then we compared it to Brandt's device, which showed that in similar conditions, having independent drive assemblies go through that same rough terrain, one tire would pick up where the other tire left off. And I don't have time to get into each nitty-gritty of functional way result. That was presented by our expert, and that should have been credited.
What do we do with some of the dependent claims here? I mean, doesn't claim 4 that talks about moving the wheels up or down, but in each case, up or down, closer or farther away from the sidewalls, actually support the notion that we are talking about something between the sidewalls?
Sure. The best case to point to is the Liebel-Florsheim case, which I don't have the site with me. And that's part of the problem with how everyone's viewed figures 2 through 4. It combines two aspects of the invention that are separated in the claims, and rightfully separated, because on the one hand, this adjustable mounting bracket with clevis does allow you to apply it to various hoppers in the industry. So you could envision it being used, for example, as an aftermarket device. But that particular aspect of the invention is not claimed in Claim 1, and we are entitled under the law to claim that aspect separately, which is what we've done here. I think the claims okay. really spell that out.
Okay, anything else? All right, you're past your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
This court is adjourned. The case will be taken under advisement.
All rise.